Okay. So, Mark, one of my interests in turbulence is in finding some kind of reduced description of turbulence. And that can mean many things. And Marcus and I have been discussing some of our ideas, and we thought you might have some feedback, want to collaborate with us on some of the ideas that we have. So let me just give a little quick overview of the historical approaches that have been used in the past. I did put a few papers on the reference section with historical information, including shell models. There's a nice book by Philip Holmes and Lumley and Berkus on trying to extract from a flow what are the dominant eigenfunctions empirically, and then using them to describe turbulence as a basis.
Proper,
and it's a nice idea.
Proper orthogonal decomposition.
This is known by that name. It's known also as empirical orthogonal eigenfunctions, or the statisticians and biologists call it PCA, principal component analysis. It's all the same. Yeah, and it's a nice idea. I'm not sure if that book was written in 96. Yeah. And I'm not sure what's been done since then. You know a little more about that. I'll let you talk more about that area. Perhaps I'll just begin with the historical approach originally around the time when Craikman started his work in the late 50s and early 60s. He started with a Fourier representation. Usually he considered the case. He was looking at isotropic homogeneous turbulence. And he looked at the case where the box was infinitely large, so he used a Fourier integral transform. And then wanted to consider the equations for the evolution of the correlation function, the two-point correlation function. And so I want to tell you a little bit about statistical closures. There's different ways we can go. I could begin with I think it would help Claude Cambon tomorrow. It would help if I could introduce statistical closures to you. It might be a good time to do that anyway. I have a little tutorial. I either have a talk that I gave before with some slides on it, or I can write out the equations on the board. They're not that bad. I'll try to keep it rather schematic. Okay, so it's just a cartoon. Just in the spirit of our last session, the constants out front have no meaning. Okay. And it's just the idea. So when we say that you have some nonlinear equation with a quadratic nonlinearity in it, and then there's some viscous term. This is just the coefficient. Okay. This is perhaps written. Let's write this in Fourier space. So we'll write it like this. And so this new k is some it's molecular viscosity times k squared. Okay, so let's already transform to Fourier space. And of course, the advective nonlinearity transforms into something like this. And this is some kind of convolution. So I've got an extra index q there, which is really, it's really k minus p here. Is really what that means, okay. Okay, so this coefficient here includes the convolution there that says it's interacting triads that are important here. Anyway, I don't care about all these indices. I'm going to erase them all. I just want to give you, I want to emphasize that we are working in Fourier space here. And Craikman, in 1958, a series of papers, 1961, was interested in the problem of computing from this the correlation function. He wants to compute, in general, the two-time correlation function, and there are two wave numbers, too. So it's a difficult problem for a nonlinear equation to evolve find the equation for the evolution of these correlation functions like this. So we call this C of t prime. And of course, it has wave number indices on it, too, like that. Okay, but I'm going to drop the indices here just to keep things very schematic. Okay, so this is the definition of that. So we're thinking of a psi as maybe it's the stream function or something, or it could be the vorticity. and we're going to evolve this. And the question is, given the primitive equation here, what are the equations for this? And of course, this is the classical closure problem. This is what statistical closures were invented for, to try to somehow close this in a reasonable way. And there is no reasonable way. Although there are some nice formalisms, like the formalism Martin, Sigge, and Rose, which puts this in a nice theoretical framework, but it still wasn't really practical. It's not easy to solve even the lowest order of that hierarchy. Turns out to be the one that Creighton was working on, and it's inexact, and in fact it even doesn't get the Kolmogorov slope right, because it has an extra, it's an Eulerian renormalization of the problem, and any Eulerian renormalization is going to have this problem. Creighton, or actually Edwards pointed this out, that it's going to capture, there's going to be spurious, unphysical sweeping or interaction between the large scale sweeping, a mean uniform flow, and an eddy. So basically, a uniform flow distorts eddies in an unphysical way. And that's one of the big problems with Creighton's direct interaction approximation. There were ways around this. One of them is to work in a Lagrangian frame. That's also very difficult. And I don't believe anyone's actually ever computed the Lagrangian history DIA, certainly not in any practical way. The DIA, even the Eulerian DIA, is extremely difficult to solve. What people do is Markovianize it. And there are, I think Claude will be talking a little bit tomorrow about some Markovian closures. One of the big issues in all of these closures is realizability. And that is, we're going to write down an approximate evolution equation for DC DT, how this thing evolves in time. And even the equal time version, you can set these two times equal. Even that is a difficult problem. And one of the issues is this thing, especially if you set the wave numbers equal here, these are often these are usually complex numbers because we've Fourier transformed here. So I'll use star for complex conjugate. As you can see here, this equal time correlation function should be non-negative. There are certain realizability inequalities, this one Schwartz, Cauchy-Schwartz inequalities, things like that, that have to be, again, Creighton wrote a paper in 61 emphasizing this. If this, we're going to write down an approximation, we don't know the exact evolution for this. If we write down an approximation for this, we want it to be maybe not the exact solution to this, the moments of this equation, but we want it to be the exact solution to moments of some other fictitious equation out there. There should be some underlying equation, perhaps it's a Langevin equation, that's typically the case, for which this is the exact solution, this equation that we're about to write down. So let me just show you kind of a schematic of how closures were, you know, the naivest things you could try to do to write down an equation for this second moment. Okay, so I'll write it like this. And then, so you get two terms, and you plug in the equation of evolution, the one we have up there. And of course, the classic closure problem is that you know this, that's what you're evolving, but you don't know this. And so, well, first thing you do is ignore it. Of course, if you ignore it, that's tantamount to ignoring your nonlinearity completely. We don't want to do that. That would be just linear theory. So you have to close at one higher level. And so let's try to do that. Let's now write down the evolution equation for this. And then you get something like that. Involving the evolution of the triplet involves the quadruplet here. And so so what you could do in the quasi-normal closure, which is the simplest thing to try, it turns out not to be realizable, so I don't recommend this, but what you could do is to adopt Gaussian initial conditions. So this is with Gaussian initial conditions, it's not completely Gaussian, because if it was completely Gaussian, you wouldn't have this term at all, right? So clearly, turbulence is not really Gaussian. People often claim that closures are Gaussian. That's completely wrong. The quasi-normal closure, however, does assume Gaussian initial conditions, and so that then you can use a Green's function. There's a Green's function there. And I'm integrating over t bar here. So the bar represents the argument of psi. This is psi of t bar here. And I'm being very schematic. I'm not worrying about the different wave numbers in here. Those things, the details aren't important. I just want to show you kind of how the structure of Sisso closure theory works. And so what we're going to do now is, because we have Gaussian initial conditions, we're going to make the quasi-normal approximation that we can split this thing up into three terms. There's four choose two ways of doing that. In other words, there's three ways of doing that. And you get these three terms here. So this is ignoring the cumulants, right? That's what you're doing. And for Gaussian statistics, that would be fine. But of course, this system isn't Gaussian. And so when you do all this, you get the quasi-normal closure. It looks like this. And there's a time history integral, which is what makes these things expensive to compute in practice. And the Markovian closures try to get rid of that time history integral in favor of some kind of measure of the interaction time. And so you'll hear more about that tomorrow. Anyway, I just want to mention that this is non-realizable. That was shown by Orgura in 1963, and also in Orzag in 1973 wrote about that. So what is the fix then? How do you fix this non-realizability? What you do is replace this by, you recognize this is the Green's function of the unperturbed problem when there's no nonlinearity, and the unperturbed problem here when there's no nonlinearity. That's the Green's function for it. So we should, what the renormalization step does is it replaces the linear Green's function with a nonlinear Green's function. We'll call it G. And the equation for G, I'll write down here. Is driven by an infinitesimal source. I'm going to put a wiggle on this. This is the perturbed nonlinear Green's function, and we need to take the ensemble average of that to get the its statistical mean. And that's what we're going to replace this by the statistical mean of that. And so then we get a couple set of equations that look like this. This is just the general kind of form of a statistical closure. Please take this number 18 with a grain of salt. Not all the terms actually are there. But if you count them, there's in principle, a possibility for 18 different pieces to appear. And I'm not being careful about the time indices either. I've written it down a little more. So this is what you get from this procedure, okay? So this is basically a recipe for getting things like the direct interaction approximation. There's two steps. One is you have the cumulant, you neglect cumulants, and secondly, you replace the linear Green's function with a nonlinear one. And so it's a two-step recipe, and from that you can get things like the DIA. And the DIA, the direct interaction approximation, has this final form
Is there a motivation for the nonlinear Green's function formalism here?
Well, that's what the president called that, the response function.
He called it the response function.
So knowing the system always, you have to study that at the state, not in the amplitude state, in the Fourier amplitude.
Right, that's the
so
thing.
It's absolutely. It's a very active response to any perturbation, and you have to actually take that care. And so that's what the Christian fundamental contribution to this
exactly.
Common
yeah.
theory, or what a typical field theory, is that the correlation function alone do not determine the whole thing.
Right.
You have the correlation and the response function all together. That's the fundamental.
Kraithman's insight was to imagine working already in the fully developed system, and then pulling one triad out of the full system. And his arguments are based on kind of looking at the problem from this other point of view, rather than adding triads in to build up the whole system. He started with the full system, took one triad out, and asked what would happen. Okay.
And so, is there a system then for which this formalism would actually be exact?
Yes.
There is. There is. He had a random coupling model, right?
Random coupling model consisted in replace the M by a random coefficient. And you consider
the random.
Yeah.
You can not consider just one system. You consider infinite number of those, which has a probability there.
Yes.
And in the limit of the goes to infinity, that the size of the number of systems goes to infinity, is incredible.
And there's also an underlying Langevin equation for the DIA. However, that's recently for a particular problem with a non-uniform shear, where many people believe the DIA should work and should be realizable. Maida and colleagues, Eidenhoven and Van Eidenhoven and another guy, Kramers, I think.
Oh, yeah.
These three guys showed at the Kron Institute, they showed that a case where they claim the DIA is not realizable. And so this was a surprising thing. I don't think anybody cares about it anymore, but certainly 20 or 30 years ago, people would have really cared. It does seem a little surprising. There is a possibility where one of Kraithman's proofs of realizability, he had two. One was this random coupling model, and that's a special case for Navier-Stokes without shear. Maybe it's okay there. I don't know. But the Langevin problem, the Langevin model, underlying model, there is actually a problem with it. And I encountered this when I looked at the realizability of Markovianized versions of the DIA. There were issues there as well with this. It had to do with whether you could factor the nonlinear noise term in the Stissel closure, whether you could factor it into two pieces, which were the forcing for the Langevin function. I won't go into the details, but I will write down the sort of general form of Stissel closure, what it gets, what the DIA and all these other ones that we'll be, I think, hearing a little bit about maybe tomorrow in Claude's talk, Claude Cambon. But Marcus and I want to get on to other things, so I don't want to spend too much time on this. Get all the indices right. Not that it really matters right now. This is the nonlinear noise term here. And they're pretty messy equations.
This G stands on the integral, not C.
This is a G.
This is the G. And the factor before it's noise?
This is the noise term. I'll write this in a nicer, much more pleasing theoretical way in a second here. Which emphasizes the realizability.
So can you also explain what you mean by realizability?
What
do you mean by realizability?
Realizability means that the approximation that we make here in writing down this equation is not the exact solution to the original equation, but it's the exact statistical solution to some other equation. Some
does not mean the spectrum must be positive, or there is no.
It means the spectrum.
That it means that the spectrum must be positive.
That's a consequence of it.
Yeah.
But it means more than that.
It's marginal.
It means that this is really.
The matrix has to be definite positive.
Exactly. Yes,
combination
exactly.
Matrix.
If you think of this as a matrix in two variables,
more than that.
It has to be.
If you look at anisotropic turbulence, you have not to look only at the one spectrum. You have
there are many. There are many other realizability inequalities. Creighton has a paper in 1961 called "Realizability Inequalities." I think that's what it's called. And but certainly these are consequences. You want the spectrum to be positive for sure. Yeah, the equal time spectrum. Okay. So anyway, you have this structure. Notice that the correlation and the correlation response function, the two time these two time functions are driven by the same left hand side here, the same operator on the left hand side. And we can actually make use of that. That's actually very nice. So I won't give you the form for sigma and f, but they are basically. The sigma is half of these. A bunch of these terms are in the sigma, and a bunch of these terms are in the f. Okay, but I just want to emphasize the structure. One of the nice things is you can think of this. There's some operator. I'll write L. It doesn't mean it's linear. It's not. Okay, there's some operator L on G, which gives you one. And so somehow L is G inverse. And so that means what you've really got here is the equation is that G inverse times C is equal to f times g. Now notice the indices are reversed here. So I've really got a Hermitian transpose there. And then you can write this in another. So this is the DIA. And many other closures can be written in this nice compact form. And the whole realizability issue comes down to whether this thing is positive definite. If this thing's positive definite, then so will C.
John,
so that's Creighton's proof of realizability in a nutshell.
John,
okay.
So your sigma here and times C, right?
Yes.
Does that replace the M?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Then I need to write it down. Yeah.
MGCC.
Yes. Yeah.
It's easy about this is because you can sort of maintain the sort of linear structure in C, not the quadratic structure in C. So you put one C in the sigma. Right.
Okay. Now,
so C is sigma is actually
there's a CP and a CQ here. This is FK, and this one has a P and a Q.
Okay.
These details matter, but I'm not going to put all the indices in.
Okay. So there are C's in the sigma. Actually.
There are C's in the sigma. These are highly nonlinear. These are highly nonlinear equations.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So although I wrote L here, that didn't mean linear. I needed some thing for an operator. Okay. Anyway, this is just a quick tutorial on closures. That's really all I want to say about them, because there's other things that we want to get on to. One of the next things that was done historically in 1974 by Gletzer, and then later on by Okatani and Yamada in 1987, were shell models. And shell models were a way of doing something that Creighton hadn't done here yet. What he had done was look at the closure problem, but he hadn't really reduced the number of moments. And from a computational point of view, that's a serious problem. So first of all, these equations are much harder to solve than the original primitive equation. And so why on earth would somebody even be doing this? Well, there was a reason. And the reason was, and it kind of gets to what I want to tell you about today, the reason that people like Creighton and Orszag and many others looked at closures is that these are smoothly varying in wave number, so you don't need to keep all of the modes. You only need to keep one representative mode for a whole region of wave number space because you're supposed to be smoothly varying functions. You know, whenever you write down an energy spectrum, you're assuming that the energy is a relatively smooth, you know, power law with respect to wave number. So that was the whole motivation behind looking at closures, because Creighton really had this in mind, and for evidence of that, if you look at Creighton and Leith, they had a paper in 1971 in the Journal of Atmospheric Sciences, a couple of papers actually, where they decided to introduce shells in wave number space. So this is K. And in fact, the shells weren't even necessarily uniformly spaced. I think they used geometrically spaced shells. in wave number with the idea of capturing a power law. That this might be the most numerically efficient way to capture a power law spectrum. So the idea would be then they would just have one Fourier mode per shell. However, it was completely isotropic, so this would only be good for isotropic turbulence. Well, in 1987, and even earlier, in, built on the, based on the 1974 work of Gletzer, Yamada and Okitani did was they decided to look at this problem differently. They decided to look at just couplings between shells and ask yourself, what is the simplest system I could write down that conserves energy, has only its nearest neighbor couplings, and you know, has the same kind of quadratic nonlinearity as in the Navier-Stokes equation. So they wrote down a toy model. So that was the Goy shell model. So it was two different papers. This was the 87. It was a fully complex version. It was more general than the one in 74 by Gletzer. And so those were the initials, where the initials G-O-Y come from the three authors. And there have been extensions of it, the Sabra model. And we can maybe talk about those models another day. It's certainly something I'm interested in. But I wanted to just mention their existence because they kind of underlie the shell models and the work of Craig and Leith underlie the work I'm going to tell you about now. First, I'll tell you about my PhD thesis work. It was in plasma physics. We took one of these Markovian closures that were based on Markovianizing these equations. They were used in plasma physics. They're used in geophysics, where one tries to, one basically new is now complex. It has real and imaginary parts. And one wants to renormalize not only the real part, but also the imaginary part, too, which represents waves. So we had non-Hermitian effects in our underlying dynamics. Those non-Hermitian effects broke down the classical proof of realizability of one of the popular Markovian versions. So it's called the eddy-damped quasi-normal Markovian closure. It's a big, long. Multiple. This is realizable without waves, but it's non-realizable. And it's the DIA-based one. There are other phenomenological versions. And it's not, there are even issues with the realizability of them. But they don't realize, the phenomenological ones do not give you a prescription. How do you renormalize the viscosity? They tell you how to renormalize the real part, but they don't tell you what to do about the imaginary part. And sometimes people just ignore the renormalization of the imaginary part. So you're going to tell us more about these issues tomorrow. OK. So it's non-realizable with waves. Anyway, I was implementing these closures on shells like this, except I made the shells anisotropic. That would be the obvious sort of thing to do. So I generalized Craighton and Leith's scheme for implementing closures on an anisotropic shells like that. However, I was at a conference once when someone asked me, it was Ron Waltz, I give him credit for this idea, even though he's long since forgotten about this. He came up to me and said, well, if you figured out how to bin up the wave number space like this so that you conserve energy and entropy. I was working on 2D turbulence, okay? So I conserve both energy and entropy. If you figured out how to do that for closures.
It makes no sense to conserve electricity, for example, in a one-dimensional shell model.
Well, in okay, now in, shell models are 1D. I wasn't talking about shell models, but let's go back to shell models. Shell models may be 1D, but they're designed to represent usually either 2D or 3D, and they're different coefficients. And one of the problems with shell models, helicity too. They will conserve helicity as well.
It's a kind of, it's not true helicity.
It's something that's supposed to mimic. None of it's
symbolic,
true.
Symbolic.
It's symbolic, absolutely, yeah. It has a plus and minus sign that reflects the cross product, yeah. But I should emphasize that these shell models are totally toy models. They're just dreamed up, okay? The coefficients, nobody's really connected them to the Navier-Stokes equation, although there were some attempts to do that. But no one's really been successful in doing that. Because for one thing, the shell models generally have only nearest neighbor interactions. They don't have long wavelength interactions, like for these isosceles triangles, non-local interactions, what I'm saying. Okay. So what I was doing with my closures, with these Markovian closures, was obviously I couldn't solve, they're complicated equations. I couldn't handle too many modes. So I had to do some kind of reduction. And Ron Walz came by at a conference and he asked me, well, if you can apply this to closures, why don't you apply it directly to the primitive equation? It's so much easier, it's a much simpler equation than all this mess. So why don't you apply it to there? Well, I said, well, you can't do that. That won't possibly work because the stream function, or the vorticity, whatever you're evolving, is a highly fluctuating quantity. It isn't smooth in wave number, or in time, for that matter. And so the kind of approximation I made here that I'm about to show you how I do it, it didn't seem justified at all. There was no slowly varying wave approximation of wave number where I could just use one mode to represent the value in every. So I'm now going to show you. Nevertheless, I tried Ron Walz's idea, and I got a surprising result. And this is when I met Grisha, because you noticed the preprint. This is the paper on spectral reduction. And you noticed the preprint, and you noticed that our findings supported a calculation you had done showing there were no intermittency corrections in 2D. I don't know if it's right or not, but that was what we found. In the 2D entropy cascade, we got the K^-3 spectrum predicted by Craikman, Leith, and Batchelor, along with the logarithmic correction that Craikman had predicted, and to very high accuracy. And even the structure functions agreed. I think that was the agreement with your papers. You had computed what the structure function should be, and we got a very nice fit with that. However, there's still a lot of issues with the method that have to be solved before it's useful. So let me tell you now about this method. It's called spectral reduction. We're just trying to reduce the number of spectral modes we have to keep around. And so we'll get rid of all this closure stuff. It's basically what I'm trying to do is find, I've given up on closures, and I'm trying to find a way to avoid having to do a closure in the first place. So it's a way of kind of circumventing the closure problem, not solving it. Okay, get rid of all the closures off the board. We don't want them anymore. All right. Until tomorrow. Then we'll talk about them more. All right, so let's start over. And let's introduce some kind of binning. First of all, I like to use vorticity now. And I'll explicitly define the interaction coefficient. These are wave numbers, they're 2D wave numbers. We're just going to do this in 2D. You can do it in 3D too, but let's first see if it's right in 2D, because it's easier to verify there. And this is the point I was at, I got to 10 years ago, and then ran into a problem. And it's still sitting there waiting for someone to help me solve the problem. Maybe it's impossible. Maybe, I think in your words, Grisha, I remember you telling me a few years ago that the problem with this method is I was trying to fool God. You remember saying that? Yeah. And the, but basically, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to use fewer modes than maybe you need in the system. Nevertheless, let's see. Let me show you the idea and see if there's anything to it. So what I'm going to introduce is, in wave number space, we're going to introduce some kind of binning like I had there before. And the binning is completely arbitrary. I don't care how you do it. This is one particular pleasing way of distributing, I'm superposing grid onto wave number space. This is one way of doing it. You could use Cartesian bins. The Fourier origin is here in the middle. So this is K space. What I'm going to do is I've got underlying Fourier modes. I'm going to try to replace them with a representative mode that understands their statistics, OK? It carries some of the same statistical properties that those original modes have. So the idea is that by understanding its statistics, that we can understand something about this equation here. All right. So the first thing you do is we need a definition for this thing. I'm going to define it very simply to be simply a bin averaged vorticity. I'll divide by, this is the area of the bin. Okay, so this is bin K. I'll take a bigger picture here. Okay, that's K, and these are the little modes K. And I'll use little, small symbols for the fine vorticity. So here I'm now actually going to work in a box, and I'm imagining working in a box. But I could allow that box size again go to infinity. So these fine modes are just the continuum here, the way of representing it. In any case, the small letters represent the finest scale, the fine modes, and the big letters represent the coarse grained modes, the bin average vorticities like that. So the first thing you do is you write down an equation for that vorticity, and you find you get equation like this. So I just integrate this equation. And I'll have to put the delta k there. We just integrate this equation. Maybe we can save ourselves some time here. This should be in here too. Okay, so we have something like that. And then, I didn't tell you about what this coefficient is. I want to tell you that too. This is just the cross product you have coming from the stream function. The velocity is z hat cross grad psi, where z hat is the vector perpendicular to the plane of motion. Okay. So this is this coefficient epsilon kpq. I chose this notation deliberately because it has the same anti-symmetry that the Levi-Civita symbol has. This is the dot product of z hat with p cross q. And because of this condition here, I can change q to k minus p. And you see this is really the same thing as p cross k. And so now you see you've got anti-symmetry in all three indices. It's that anti-symmetry that underlies energy conservation and entropy conservation. Energy being that thing there. And I should really be taking the absolute. I'm going to just take a look at the real case where everything's real, so I don't have to worry about stars. I should mention something about the symmetry here. You might have expected this to be k minus p minus q. I've just changed p to minus p and q to minus q. And so I really should write this to be correct. because that's the realizability condition I've used. Let's take everything to real, be real, so we don't have to worry about stars today. Okay, and then you can write it like this. And entropy is just, again, the mean squared vorticity. And so it looks like that. All right, so I'm going to be very cavalier about whether I write integrals or sums. Okay, it doesn't matter.
We know could it be actually be a volume? Could it be in 3D?
You can do this in 3D too. Let's first do it in 2D though. Okay.
But yeah. You have to I've do done it in 3D. Eigen mode decomposition, like 1F called helical mode decomposition, which diagonalizes the curve. And in this case, you have.
He
doesn't
you can
anything here. Every complexity will be in how the
But if you want to have a simple equation which show immediately that you have both conservation of energy, detailed conservation, triad by triad, detailed conservation of energy
and
conservation of helicity, it's much better to use eigen, the eigen mode, which the, and you have exactly the same.
I have
the problem is, even with the orthogonal decomposition, nobody has ever found anything like that yet. So even the orthogonal decomposition is a tool, has not been found useful here at all yet.
Yeah, I have
nobody has ever fabricated orthogonal basis, based sort of decomposition to rewrite the newly normalized equation like he wanted to.
There is a way to do it.
It's much more, for example, in the for 2D, you find a very simple coefficient antisymmetric, as told by John, like a k squared minus q squared. And you have exactly the same, like with plus minus q modulus, plus minus p modulus, using the helical mode.
It's more complicated.
It's just a formal.
Because actually, supposing you decompose in orthogonal mode, you still have to understand how the orthogonal mode interact with it.
You have your chance.
Great model. And that process is all open. So before I understand this, choosing the orthogonal or non-orthogonal, you miss a big factor and you take care of your epsilon. So listen to him. This is so more complicated.
There's much more going on here.
Much more complicated.
This is not the somewhere here. Let's talk about the 3D stuff later. Let me just say there is a way to get to make everything I say here to work in 3D as well. So let's not get distracted by that. You need two variables. You have to evolve two variables, but you can get that way. Coarse graining of both that conserves both energy and helicity. But let's first understand the 2D case where helicity is also conserved. It just happened to be zero. Okay. Okay. Well, it's a good thing that zero is conserved. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm just integrating this equation over a bin. And so what I have is epsilon kpq over q squared. There's an integral here I didn't bother writing. Integral over sum over p integral q. We'll write it as integral. And then now I have an integral over k, integral over p, integral over q. I make a p, I make a q. And then I have to divide by delta k. All right. So that's what I've got so far. And I want to rewrite this in a nicer way as I'm going to introduce, I didn't tell you what this angle average is. The angle average is, it should have been obvious. It's just an integral over the bin. And then I'm going to take an angle. I'm going to define a new symbol. I'll do it over here. APQ, which is a symmetric version of that. It's now symmetric. This is over bin K. So delta K is the area of bin K. And this one is going to divide by delta K, delta P, delta Q, and then integrate over all three of those wave numbers coming from each of the respectively labeled bins, k, p, or q. So there's an averaging operator, dk, dp, dq, dq, dp, dk, I guess. OK.
And you have some delta function.
And the delta function is in here.
Right.
It's in here.
Yeah,
OK. And I'm just.
Yeah, OK.
That's just an aside. OK. All right. So I'm going to use that notation now to rewrite this as So this, we have this triple integral over delta. That's the same thing as this times delta p delta q. And there's a fundamental question here that I want to ask everyone in a couple minutes as to what people do, say, in statistical mechanics when you do chord screening. People do this all the time. I'm not a physicist anymore, at least. I've switched to being a mathematician, an applied mathematician. So I'm getting a little rusty in my statistical mechanics, and maybe somebody can remind me what one does when one chord screens in order to get the correct statistical equipartition. That's the fundamental failing of this method, and I'll get to that in a minute. But first of all, what is the method? What I'm going to do, what I've done so far, is simply write down the exact equation. This is the exact equation. Completely useless, though. Did I forget something? I forgot the delta p and the delta q, right? And I have to sum over all bins p and all bins q. The reason for that is, over here, this was an integral over R2. This was an integral over R2. I should have been a little more careful here. So dp, dq, these go over all space. Okay. Of course, the delta function restricts q, in effect, right? So there's really only a two-dimensional integral there, not four-dimensional. But formally, it's nice to write things this way. The integral over R2 can then be written as a sum of integrals over various values, a sum over q of various values of q, and then the integral integrates within bin q. Okay, so that that when I sum up all these integrals over q, I get I've tiled the plane. Okay, this thing's supposed to tile the whole plane, all of R2. All right. So what I do, where's the closure? This is still all exact. There's no swindle yet, but I'm about to make the swindle. The swindle is a terrible one, and it's simply to pull these things out and assume that they can somehow, in some very rough way, be approximated by their bin average value. Not a very nice thing to do, and you'll probably ask me, what can we go to higher order? You can try, but it's already hard enough at lowest order. Let's focus on that first. Okay, there are a couple things you can do to try to go to higher order. None of them have been practical yet at this point. The one thing that has worked is to pull these out. Okay, so let's pull them out. I should emphasize that the coarse grain quantities are chosen so that they are the typical value of a vorticity in a bin, in the sense of the integral mean value theorem. This is exactly equal to omega c for some t in bin K. We just don't know which one it is. That's assuming that the vorticity is continuous in wave number. All right. So because of that, I'm going to bring these out. And because of that assumption, I make this terrible assumption. This is no longer the Navier-Stokes equation. It's some other equation. I'm going to do the same to this one, too. I'm going to pull it out. And I'll simply use the bin average viscosity here. This is viscosity times k squared, remember, OK? Or any other viscosity operator. It could have wave effects in it. Lots of things could be in there. But here's my new equation. This is a new auxiliary equation. And I've made a terrible approximation. And in fact, it's so bad that that energy isn't even conserved. Entropy is. Maybe I should just remind you, why is energy conserved? Well, let's talk about entropy first. OK, so why is entropy conserved? If I multiply by another omega k here, again, not worrying about the stars, OK, entropy will get set new to 0. And the reason entropy is conserved is that when I sum over k, the whole equation, I've got now something that is symmetric in omega k, p, and q, but anti-symmetric in over here in k and p. Okay, so it's anti-symmetric in anti-symmetric say in k and p, and yeah, see, we can't say q, but it's anti-symmetric in k and p, and it's symmetric here in KNP. So I've got the product of a symmetric tensor and anti-symmetric tensor summed up, right? And so that's zero. So that's what makes entropy conserved. What makes energy conserved? You have this k squared here. So what happens if I put a k squared on the bottom here and here? What happens when I do that? Well, then, now the symmetry that matters is that if I interchange k and q, I've got symmetry here and anti-symmetry here. That gives me zero. The same sort of thing can be done here. So what makes entropy conserved? What makes entropy conserved is that I switch, again, I switch k and p. And so, you know, again, I multiply by omega k here, the usual thing, multiply the whole equation by that. And now switch k and p. And this is symmetric, and this thing is anti-symmetric. It's very easy to show that. It's just a change of variables. You change the outer variable here, and then you change the inner integration variable here. You do a change of variables, and you see right away this has the right symmetry. Everything's good. So entropy is still conserved. However, energy conservation has been lost. And the reason is that the symmetry you need is now this one. Because by energy, you have to ask yourself what you mean. But one reasonable definition of the coarse-grained energy is this. I have to put a bin area here, because the bigger the bins are, the more the energy there is. Okay, so there is this bin factor here, and same with this one. So this is the coarse-grained entropy. And you do need this bin factor. I guess I kind of glossed over that. In fact, I probably should write down the right equation so you can see that. I meant to do that, and I thought I had. There was supposed to be a delta P, delta Q here. And that's because when I went from here to here, I had a sum over P of integrals over P. And then I had to multiply by delta P, delta Q. So in fact, let's just write it like this. This is what I used. This is what appeared in the equation. And I simply dropped that in. So there was a delta P, delta Q. So when I multiply by omega k, I also have to multiply by delta k to get entropy conserved. To get energy conserved, I also have to divide by k squared. And now I'm in trouble, because the requisite symmetry mixes coarse scale and fine scale information. And that's bad. So we fix it up. There's an easy fix. Don't use this equation. This was the wrong one to use. I made such a terrible error going from here to here that I didn't even get energy conservation right. So we can fix it up. Just make a tiny little adjustment. Just bring that q squared outside. We're all playing around anyway. So perhaps that's actually closer to the original equation. At least it conserves now energy as well as entropy. Because now you see, and in fact, you might wonder about the error I made here. But the whole point here is that we can make these bins small enough so that q squared, a smooth number, doesn't really vary very much over a bin. And it should be possible to well approximate it by big Q squared, within 10% or something. That's kind of the idea. In fact, the wonderful thing about this method is, unlike statistical closures, the approximation we're making is controllable. In fact, you can make the bins so small that they each contain one mode. In that case, this is exact. Of course, it's completely useless then. However, what if it has two modes per bin? And that's why I originally did it, because I wondered, somewhere along the way, it's going to break. And where is that? Okay. And to my surprise, it didn't break, even where there are thousands of modes in a bin. That was my surprise, at least in one case, in the entropy cascade in 2D. But something does go wrong. And I found that only later when I did more tests looking at the inverse cascade. And the problem is, first the good news. I should mention these coupling coefficients here are complicated, but they can be computed for a bin like this with a combination of analytical and numerical techniques. That's a solved problem. And with Cartesian bins, you can make bins that look like this. You get the idea. This is a particularly nice geometry for Cartesian bins, you can calculate those coefficients analytically, completely analytically, using the contour integral. So it's kind of a nice calculation. But and that's done at the beginning of the run. It's independent of time. That's the important thing. You calculate these renormalized bin coupling coefficients. And it kind of tells you how much energy, how many modes in bin P and bin Q, it's a count, how many modes in bin P and Q interact with modes that are in bin K. Okay?
These are just geometrical factors.
They're just geometrical factors. You compute them once and for all, and they're actually expensive enough to compute for this bin that I store them to disk.
But still curious to me.
Of course, you could just counting. I mean, it's just the counting, really.
Yeah. But what that depends on. So, for example, if I redistribute the band, take even not exponential, super exponential, for example.
Yeah.
Would you get the same thing, or it's different?
Oh, it's different. Yeah. I mean, it
depends really.
Yeah,
on
I didn't have
partition.
Absolutely. Yeah, it depends very much on the partitioning, and you can do the so far what I've said. I haven't. The only thing I really require with these bins is that they are connected sets.
Okay.
And that's so I can apply the mean value theorem at some point. And I'll maybe get to that today, or maybe not. Because we have to, Marcus
but
wants to talk to things too.
We'll get into the expression for the...
Pardon me?
We'll get to, when you do the numerical calculation.
Yes.
Well, what's the labor really involved in that?
Well, it's a two-dimensional integral.
Okay.
A two-dimensional, a nested integral, right. And I use an adaptive Simpson technique because it has lots of Heaviside functions in it, which come from our friend, the delta function.
The counting number of modes coming from here.
Yeah.
How their weights.
I mean, the calculation I usually do, the one that's really most efficient, is the continuum version, where I start off with Fourier integrals here.
Yeah.
Okay, and that one you can do partially analytically, but you still get down to a two-dimensional integral you have to do. And that's just a little bit time-consuming, especially if you have a lot of bins. In the end, the kind of reduction, just to give you an idea, instead of doing a 1024 by 1024 pseudo-spectral simulation, you can do this with like 16 radial bins and 8 angular bins. So it's a huge reduction in the number of modes that you need.
What do you actually lose when you do this?
So what goes wrong? Okay, well, what goes wrong is this equipartition theorem. So the good news is that this thing has a Liouville theorem. And it conserves energy and conserves entropy. And if you also believe that the system is mixing, then that guarantees that you could get these equipartition spectra. And so for 2D, the equipartition spectra, the energy spectrum you're expecting to get is proportional to to get this right this time. To that, it means that each mode has the same amount of something as every other mode. And that something is a linear combination of energy and entropy, determined by alpha and beta. So alpha plus beta k squared times the energy in each mode, Ek, which is just omega k squared over k squared. This should be constant. This is our equipartition. Okay, that's in the original dynamics. That's what this does. What this one does, it's the exact same thing. It sees the omega k doesn't know where it came from. This is just an ODE. It's an ODE that conserves energy and entropy, and it has a Liouville theorem. For all it knows, it's the same equation as this. From what I've said so far, in terms of its properties, it has the same three properties. So you should expect that you get this. And guess what? You do. But that's not good, because there is this slight difference. The energy here doesn't have that delta K factor, and here it does. And what this means is that if I have a uniform binning, if all the bins have the same area, then this works marvelously well, this reduction. Okay. Unfortunately, that's not the practical case. Because the whole idea here was in the viscous range at the high k's, I was going to use huge bins, okay, and try to have one mode that represents the whole dissipation region. Why should we waste 99% of our computer time on the viscous range? Yeah, that's the issue. Yes?
Yeah, so it seems to me this is like a multi-resolution method?
Yes, yes, that's the idea. And my student is coming, Malcolm Roberts, in about a week, and he's going to be here for 3 weeks working on a kind of a multi-grid scheme, but it's a multi-grid scheme cast in wave number space that tries to get around this particular problem. I've kind of given up on using anything but uniform bins. So we're using a whole nested series of uniform bins that have projection prolongation operators between them. It worked. We tried this method for shell models, and it led to some interesting. It seemed to be successful enough that we decided to then go ahead and do it for 2D turbines as well. But that's another tangent I don't want to get into today, because we have other things we want to hear about. And basically, what I want to leave you with is the question: how do you coarse grain a system? I mean, okay, I should say there is a way to fix this up. I mean, the whole troublesome thing is this factor here.
Okay, but so, if I still close my eyes and just make numerics of this model, what it would give you for turbulence?
It won't give you the inverse.
It would give you completely wrong.
It won't give you the inverse energy cascade in 2D. It does give you the correct direct cascade, but that's because of a coincidence between, I think it is, the coincidence between the k squared here, this k squared, and the fact that I happen to choose, I chose my bins so they grew with k squared. This coincidence of these two numbers meant I was lucky, and I got it to work for that one case. If I go back and redo the simulation that was in the PRL where this was published, if I go and change this to something, it always works when delta k is 1. But if I change it to k, it won't work. Or k cubed. I've even tried it, and you get the wrong spectrum. With k squared, I just happened to luck on the right particular bin size. And what's happening is the equation theorem is confusing energy with entropy, but it doesn't care. And it is a limit. There is a limit where, basically, for when beta is 0, then when beta is 0 in that case, this factor is like k squared. It thinks the alpha is really the beta. That's my rough hand-waving explanation for why I didn't notice this earlier. And
that's an appearance.
However, pardon me?
That's an appearance. I have another interpretation.
You have another interpretation, which we talked about, and that was interesting. And as certainly, this might not be right. So I'm certainly willing to entertain other explanations.
30 seconds to explain that.
For sure, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, basically, that what we do is to try to get a reduced kernel. Okay, to describe an effective interaction between the coarse grain things. Mm-hmm. All right. Now, my opinion is that this reduced kernel depends on the state. State what's telling me that how the energy actually distributed. I mean, how the energy decays. All right. So, if suppose I have an entropy cascade which is k-3, the large scale mode and the small scale mode interact in a different way. So the reduced kernel will appear differently. All right. This is important because it's a state dependent. So therefore, that the whole thing is, if you, what I advertise, and I told John what to do, is to, this is the kernel that I would like to get, all right? Why do I just take epsilon, whatever I will not write, whether it's omega, you have also p squared over here. What you do is you replace this by q squared over here, and then epsilon of this times sigma, big sigma, the q. That's what you did, right?
You want me to go further?
What I suggest him to do is to redefine this, move to this side, q squared, and over sigma p and sigma q.
Is there a systematic way to read these kinetics?
Here's my statement is that what he assumed that this one is only geometry dependent. How he did to the bands. All right, he says what I'm asking, what labor involved in computing this? He just do the counting. I think this is wrong, totally. That thing is not only geometry dependent, how you split your band, but also depend on the state. What state is how energy changes from large scale to small scale.
But then we come back to then that this should be recalculated every here and then in time.
No. Well, nature will, God will love us. If you don't fool God, yeah. God will love us.
Yeah, okay.
There are rules, actually, how this depends on the state. That you need to find. Now, let me now just briefly interpret what you get the lucky thing in the L3 cascade. When the L3 cascade, it happened that what the primary variable is omega. Omega has just an empty partition here. Each omega little thing has the same amount, same excitation, as was the same as here. That's why I get it. I think it's so much.
No, in the L3 cascade, you don't have equipartition.
Omega excitation is equipartition, not energy. When you talk about equipartition, you always speak about energy and U of K, not omega of K. Omega of K
is the
excitation everywhere.
You have the same amount of entropy in each octave.
That's it.
Yeah.
See? So, I mean, suppose you change that.
What if I use the stream function, which is off by a factor of k squared?
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
Because you are cost-learning
this. You could use the stream function, and what you get is exactly the same thing. It's just a change of variables. There's
well,
no real
so,
difference.
So, okay.
As you impose energy and energy conservation, the result is the same.
No, Gauss-graining something and Gauss-graining k squared times something is different.
Yeah.
Have
you tried it?
Yes, I have.
The original version, actually.
Yes, yeah. In fact, the original version of spectral reduction was with the stream function.
Data is the omega.
What happens is the reason it's the same is that, see, I pull out the necessary factors to get energy and entropy conservation. So the extra k squared factors.
Are
pulled out anyway, and in the end, it ends up to be exactly the same combination.
You immediately make the prediction. If you deal with the stream function, you can pull out another factor.
I mean, absolutely. I pull out different factors. Yeah. You could also have something like this.
Yeah.
Like there is a version of KPQ here.
That means that effectively you still got the rank your omega.
It's the same, exactly. Yeah.
But
so I don't think that's it, but anyway.
One sentence. So what I advertise is the strategy to study this thing.
I agree with it. This I think is a good idea.
Because we have the whole system, we have solved the whole system. And we also could actually experience with different factors.
If you do this anyway, numerically, can't you simply erase it? I mean, try to estimate this, the epsilon omega q. That's omega k omega q over q squared.
Mm-hmm.
But he
wants to. I mean, he says this is first principles. We're trying to do something. It's too hard a problem. Try to go back to Navier-Stokes. Maybe we should think of this as a coefficient that we want to compute from the flow.
Yeah.
You know, some kind of hybrid empirical.
Oh, okay.
So what I mean is that the first statement of what I just say that can be tested. You just recalculate for different state and just to look at the scaling property of that and to see whether it's scale dependent. That's the first thing that can be tested.
Okay, I just want to say two more sentences really about areas that I haven't talked about. And I should say there's a little bit more justification for it. I've presented it as a toy model. There is a way to understand what I'm doing here when you look at moments of this. If you take moments of this equation, and you take moments of this equation, the equations are very close together. That doesn't mean the solutions are close together, but it gives us some hope. There might be something to all this, after all. And that's how I understand how it works as well as it does in the entropy cascade in 2D.
Can you estimate the error you do if you subtract the one solution from the other?
We can try. Let's try to do that during this meeting.
Yeah.
We've still got a little more time. I've never really got very far developing error estimate. Let's try.
You can just run a cross gradient to see how much you go off. That's numerically feasible.
Anyway, you want to talk, so I want to just say two more words about two more sentences here. One is there was another way of trying to account for the modes that we deleted. What we did here is we renormalized the nonlinearity from this to this. There's always, I didn't bother telling you about how I force determinants. So there's usually a forcing, and we of course we average that forcing too. So that's straightforward. L1. Does that, or you can just use white noise forcing here and use white noise forcing here at a certain rate, that'll work as well. But what I want to say is there are other approaches to this kind of idea. Creighton in 1986 developed a method called decimation, which inspired what I'm doing here. And he said, what we're going to do is to delete some of the modes and replace the modes that we've deleted with a random forcing. Somehow embed their effect into the forcing term. It's a nice idea. I think I like this better. I like what we've done here better because the modes you're deleting, they interact through nonlinearities. It makes more sense to adjust the nonlinear term than adjusting the forcing terms. The modes that are deleted aren't acting through some kind of Gaussian random forcing. So that's my problem with the decimation idea. Anyway, it's an interesting approach. And I think, if I remember correctly, your work and constrained Zhenxu Shi's work on constrained Euler decimation, is that what you called it?
1993.
Wasn't that somehow doing something to this term?
Renormalized BK.
Yeah. So there's three
different ways. Terrible integral, pretty much like what you did.
So there's three different ways of renormalizing, three different terms there that you can think of renormalizing. And of course, another classical approach from 1980, when was Yakov's paper? 81?
About what?
About RG.
86.
I guess that's right, yeah. Okay, it was 86 in the very first volume of the Journal of Scientific Computing.
Yeah.
Not the SLAM journal, the other journal. It's almost the same title.
Right.
Yeah. They came up with a way of using renormalization group theory to account for the effect of the small scale modes on the large scale modes. So that's a quick history of some ideas out there on how to reduce develop a reduced model of turbulence. In 1986, there was another. In 1996, there was a book written by Philip Holmes that we mentioned earlier on reduced models and using empirically determined eigenfunctions. And that's the kind, in that spirit, Marcus is now going to tell us about some of his ideas on how to develop a reduced model. So please have the floor and the microphone. Yeah. Sorry for taking so much of your time.
I try to make the long story short, and because actually my main concern why I talk now is because I want to hear if my ideas are complete nonsense or not, which might well be. And John gave already quite a long introduction. I will not write down all these papers. This is just for me. So what basic idea is, what I want to talk about is this proper orthogonal decomposition, its relation to the Galerkin models, and then how to decimate this. This proper orthogonal decomposition, first of all, is just a way how to decompose a field into a set of linear functions. That's the main idea. We are given some function u of x, and you want to find some representation in the following way, ij equals 1 to infinity. That's the main idea, and you want, of course, to split that. Fourier does that job, of course. For other setups, for other boundary conditions, it's maybe preferable to take, I don't know, Chebyshev. And there is a way, that was the whole idea why people started to do this empirically. What they did was they wanted to know, can I find some functions which fit exactly to the picture I have? this is just a function in space. Of course, I will not talk about vectors. This can be much more complicated, and later on it should depend on time eventually. But if I have a function which looks like this, sorry, on a bounded domain, very weird, and maybe it's not so clever to represent it in terms of Fourier because we have maybe some strange boundary conditions here, and it might be that some Gaussian functions like we have in wavelets
are much
better x and u. Well, and then we might try to fit this with a kind with ties that look like this. This can be spline based or whatever. So, and now the question is, how do I find these things empirically in a way that I have already most of the information about u in the first function, and then second most in the second function, and third most in the third function. So you see, because if I take waves, maybe I have to go to a very high wave number to represent it. Okay, that's the main idea of this thing. So you say this, and I want to have these phi optimal. And what is optimal? I will describe in a minute, I hope. So now we can write down the problem in mathematically. I don't want to do that because else I will not stop before half an hour. So I will tell you it's possible to write down the problem in a proper way, which is here. So you see, I skipped that. And basically, everything cooks down to the form that I find that the whole problem is an eigenvalue problem. It's an eigenvalue problem because you can write it without being formal. So I take the domain between 0 and 1, just to make it simple. I say this is an integral where I have now. I will explain all the stuff and not write it down because, again, this is too much stress to do. Here I have a prime. So, and that shall be phi of x. Okay, so as you see, this is an autocorrelation function. So, something where this average, this means average. Okay, over realizations. So we assume this is a random function. It's a random function where we have many realizations, and this average makes sense. If you think about turbulence, okay, you might, or about a flow, you might have several realizations for different initial conditions. So this is an average, a statistical average correlation function. And this, if I write it a bit shorthanded, again, L for generic operator, this is an eigenvalue problem. Okay, and now, as you see, this has more than one dimension, possibly. There you can find that you number these things, and you find several eigenvalues. And now the requirement is that you have number 1, number 2, number 3, and so on. And according, the functions phi I shall be ordered, shall be found such that they represent, in this case here, if this is velocity, for instance, you have energy. So this represents the case that the phi's are ordered according to the amount of energy they contain. And that's the, yeah. So lambda j corresponds to the kinetic energy in a mode. So you can go through all the calculations in detail, but that's the basic idea. What do I have to say else about this? That's it. Okay, you can consider this then.
This is all at a particular time.
So, no time yet.
Yeah.
No time yet. This comes with the Galerkin or Galerkin, I don't know. You know, how is this spelled correctly? Galerkin. What's the correct spelling?
You spelled right. You spelled right. Yeah.
Galerkin.
How is it pronounced?
Galerkin. Yeah? A Jochen, right?
Yeah. You even
German people like to pronounce the right way.
Why not? We have the possibility. Okay.
I mean the gallery in the theater, which is up there. It's basically.
Okay. You can find now these functions empirically, as we already. I'm using too much time. Empirically, we can find these functions in writing. In writing, difference between our target and the measured. So, in some field, we measure. So, if this is measured, then you of course can construct this in such a way that, again, this is our sum over j, aj, phi j, in such a way that this sum is minimal, right? And then we can apply all this thing, but there is still no time. So time comes in saying, okay, I have now a field u of x, and this goes to a u of x, so I make process out of that. And the main idea which comes in introducing dynamics, there is, of course, there's more technicality involved in this Galerkin projection method, is that I make separation answers. So I want to have functions such that the coefficients arrive with time, which is true in the case of Fourier. But this is something which might work on the paper. Okay? The main idea is to do that and then try to find what comes out of this thing. So if you have a differential equation, partial differential equation, where you have u dot equals, and then I might write n for a possible nonlinear operator, n of u, you plug that in, and then what happens is, of course, you get again a system of equation for the aj. And for Navier-Stokes, typically, because we have square nonlinearity, this is, we have in full generality, let me take here i's, some coefficients, I call it deliberately, I invent some names now, B, gamma, and of course I have Q, I, J, K, A, J, A, K. Here I have to double. Okay, this is where we started in the talk of John, and this is where I now think I want to, I'm extremely annoyed. First of all, I'm annoyed because all this is linear, is orthogonal, and we know that turbulence is not orthogonal. We have highly non-orthogonal eigenvectors. If we think about Lyapunov exponents, then we know that if we calculate the corresponding real Lyapunov vectors, they are non-orthogonal. They are bundled most of the time. Even for simple example systems, I'm not a guy that integrates Navier-Stokes numerically. So usually I avoid that. So I take simple things like Kospitayevsky, which fortunately is already a scalar, or even simpler stuff in one dimension where you have already kind of this structure. If you calculate Fourier, the Lyapunov's vectors, and this is possible, there is a method in the last years which was developed in Firenze, Florence. Mm-hmm. Then you see that what you usually do is you find the first one and then you find the second one taking some orthogonal thing, and then you find the third one taking again. Like Gram-Schmidt. That's Gram-Schmidt. So you find something, but this is not the Lyapunov vectors. The vectors themselves, they are not aligned. They are just co-moving with the trajectory. And if you have large Lyapunov exponents, they might point all in the same direction. What you do with numerically to find them is you always do this orthogonalization every here and then. But this is not correct. So this is something which, of course, is a major drawback in these models, in all these orthogonal models, to my opinion. So what one could do first is a very tedious thing. One finds the Lyapunov vectors and formulates everything in terms of Lyapunov vectors. This is something which I didn't do because I was stuck with the Lyapunov vectors. It's very complicated to complete. It's not very complicated, but I had many bugs in my program. So I stopped that. And recently I was into networks. So the idea I want to do now is actually, I want to find a way to reduce the number of components by using the idea of Perron-Frobenius. You know, Frobenius-Perron operator is something which, when applied to a stochastic matrix, it gives you the following. I think this is something, this probably most of the people know, but maybe Perron-Frobenius is something which is not so well known. So I think one can apply, one should consider this in a way that you have a flow in the network. This is all modes are interconnected. So you have mode I, which is connected to all the others by these coefficients, but as well to all pairs. We have heard it's triads. So we have to find the most important triads. And this reminded me immediately to this Perron-Frobenius stuff, which in a nutshell has the following idea. You have a graph where you want to know the invariant density given some connections. So it's a directed graph. So maybe this points like this. Yeah. I don't know if this is a good graph, probably not. But we know from the analysis on recent years, this was a big deal, all these social networks. You have hierarchical networks, and you find that the stationary density in these networks is highly non-trivial, because if this is an important, now I'm talking about importance. Importance means you have a lot of mass. You put a mass on this graph, and it doesn't disappear. So it's mass conserving. It's basically a representation of a master equation in a graphical way. Master equation means you consider the evolution of a probability density. You put some probability here, a mass, and let it evolve. And how? And you just do that in a random way. It's like a random walker on that graph, and you count how many times does this random walker pass here and there. That means how much time spends the system in this mode. If I translate this, okay? There's a way to solve this system, and this is the same method you use for PageRank. This is what you do in the internet. You search for PageRank. That means you iterate the stochastic matrix S. So if you have write this as an eigenvalue problem, you want to find your vector V. You have again an eigenvalue problem here. Then you see that if you, with an arbitrary V, then everything converges quite quickly to the largest eigenvalue V, to lambda 1. And I tell you lambda equals 1 is an eigenvalue, because this is a stochastic matrix, so it's measure conserving. So that means that S to the KV converges quite quickly to V1. V1, on the other hand, this means that you have here, so here you have nodes which have numbers. V1 gives you the weights the different nodes have. Okay? That's easy. So now you have the numbered nodes. I want to translate this now to the problem we have here. So how do I so my main problem is, I played around with that. My main problem now is, how do I construct a graph out of that? I'm done in a minute. I think this is the most difficult problem. If I want to have triads, I want to visualize this as the interaction of triads. So I make it a graph of triads. But these triads mean, here I have a node I, a mode here, which is now a node in graphical representation, and this interacts with J and K. But I have, again, wait, I sketched that. I don't want to make it mistaken, because I sketched that earlier today, and it was not yet very clever.
K, you know I, right away.
Sorry?
If you know J and K, then you know I right away. Assuming these are, right, these are indices for two-dimensional. What does that mean?
No, I'm talking about these things.
I have
here, this is the whole system of equations. For every I now have many of these JK, because you see here's the sum. Okay?
But so, there's at least in the original, in the Euler system,
yes,
when you have a convolution, then one of those indices is redundant.
John, let me go.
That's in translational invariant cases that you use Fourier. This is a generally. We're short of time. Please continue.
Okay.
Because it's not just about the finish, so
We have the same situation for J, we have the same situation for K.
Yeah.
Okay, just to make it symmetric. K, we have IJ. And now we have all these systems of trials, and we can couple them. How are they coupled? They are coupled through these coefficients, of course. Okay? So here you have coupling coefficients, which might point, so this doesn't mean that they are arbitrarily pointing forth and back. They point in one direction, but one doesn't know it, because this might be negative or positive. So, and now the idea is let the computer run and give you the rank vector of this. The ranking vector, which in this V1 we have, this is a ranking which gives you the most important importance of W. What does it mean? If I just know the interpretation, I'm done actually, but I want to say what the interpretation is. In this book of Holmes and Lumley and Berkus, they were hooked on coherent structures, actually, and this comes to one of the other topics we have on the list. They wanted to find the coherent structures in terms of these five. They said, okay, we have energy-containing modes, and these are important. We find something, for instance, for the Kármán vortex street. We find all these vortices. It's here, we have one, and we have another one. We combine these two modes. We have the driving mode, and so we have three modes, and we are almost done. This was the main idea. So it's not for fully homogeneous turbulence, it's for general setup. So now one wants to identify these structures, and once having this ranking, we have a dynamical way to tune these things. So this is the idea. And I would like to hear if this sounds completely stupid, or if you have comments like John already had to how to refine or how to structure, for instance, this graph. That's it.
Okay, yeah, let's now.